Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for being here. So after a lot of on-premises stuff already today, I thought let's bring us back into the cloud where we belong. That was a different song. So those who have seen some of my sessions before or have been into one of my sessions, I like to keep things interactive, which means if you have a question, shout or raise your hand is good as well. I have an agenda, but I don't need to run through the agenda. I can just as easily talk about anything else related to this topic in order to make sure that you have any of the questions that you have answered, okay? So this is kind of like a red line running through the presentation with some ideas, some things that I thought, hey, this is interesting to talk about, some of the experiences I've had and some majorly complex and large environments. But if you wanna bring things down to a level where you're like, hey, I want to know more about this feature, not per se in a large or complex or hybrid deployment, just more about the feature as such, then I'm more than happy to talk about that as well, right? So let's just keep it a little bit interactive. It's small enough here, we're about 30 people, so that should be manageable. This being said, what I'm going to talk about today is, you know, first give you a primer about identity in Office 365, because that'll set the tone about what we're going to talk about, right? We're going to talk about the different identity options. And then pretty quickly, I don't want to, you know, lose too much time about why things are the way they are. I want to talk about multi-forest deployments and just maybe a quick show of hands. Whom of you have already dealt with a multi-forest Office 365 deployment today? Five. Okay, that's roughly 6%. No, 20. Oh, I'm horrible. Like almost 5-6%. Anyway, or more. 50. Anyway, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Would you? So that's interesting. Whom of you is involved with multi-forest deployments? So not necessarily have gone through one, but is in the planning phase, has customers or potential customers to deal with that kind of thing? Roughly the same kind of people. Who doesn't even care about multi-forest deployments? No one. Okay, it's interesting. Anyway, so we're gonna talk about multi-forest deployments and why they are the way they are and what is important to take a look at. And then we'll dive from identity over to authentication. There is a plethora of things that you can tell about authentication. Today, I wanna talk specifically about multi-factor authentication, even within multi-factor authentication in Office 365 and by extension in Azure Active Directory, we could talk for hours and hours and hours. I'm gonna scratch the surface about some of the things, what I wanted to talk about, because it ties in neatly with the last part, which is fairly new, and that's Microsoft Passport. Some of you might know what Passport is. Some of you might even use Passport today. And I want to talk about why I believe that Passport as a feature in combination with Windows Hello is something really neat for Office 365 and how it might revolutionize how people authenticate to Office 365, new way of doing single sign-on, new experience, which, you know, when you come and take a look at how it actually works, is a quite beautiful solution. Unfortunately, as we'll see later, it's not entirely available yet for the on-premises world, Windows Server 2016. So that's a little caveat. But anyway, so those are the four major topics. And when looking into identities, right, we've got 3.5 options. Why am I referring to 3.5 options? Well, you know, first of all, cloud-only deployments are mainly based or mainly for the smallest environments, right? You sign up for a tenant, create a bunch of users, and that's it. You could scale up to 100,000 users. I have a customer that I work with. They have a tenant in Office 365 with roughly 100,000 users in there. No ties into the on-premises world. They just used Office 365. Why is that? Well, it happens to be 100,000 students in Office 365. There's no need to taking them into Active Directory. So when you talk about cloud-only identities, be careful that you do not stigmatize, you know, it's only for smaller deployments, but because it doesn't necessarily have to be, right? In conjunction with the cloud-only deployments, you have the synchronized identities. on-prem, could be Active Directory, could be something else, where you synchronize those identities and create copies of those identities in Office 365. Actually, you create them in Azure Active Directory, and they show up in Office 365. Before continuing, did Tony or did he not talk about the different forests in Office 365 and how that works together? He did. Okay. Everyone knows what I'm talking about? Okay, great. So that's why you synchronize with Azure AD and it shows up in Office 365. Interestingly enough, some of these synchronizations between the forests or the workload specific forest in Office 365 seems to be a little bit broken. And I want to take this opportunity to talk about the question you had in this morning. How do Office 365 groups relate in hybrid deployment? Well, they relate with a hybrid deployment if you have group write-back enabled. So you can have them on premises so they are addressable in Office 365. First of all, group write-back is a preview feature, which means that today, if you start using it, you're basically unsupported. Secondly, the problem that I have with the group write-back feature is if it write-backs a group into the on-premises environment, it doesn't correctly write back the group so that it automatically shows up as a distribution group in your on-premises Exchange environment, which means every cycle that you do that synchronizes back into the on-premises environment, you have to do an update recipient for that group automatically so that it shows up in your distribution list, which is somewhat of a pickle because, you know, it's a lot of work that you have to go through to make them work. That's one problem. Secondly, while addressing those groups, one of the things that we noticed is a mail object in Office in Exchange, by extension Office 365, if you will, can have a primary SMTP address and have multiple secondary SMTP addresses called proxy addresses, right? Now, one might wonder, why on earth would I want to create multiple addresses for my group? I have no idea, but there are people that want to, right? I want to have two email addresses for that group. Well, let me tell you, there is a feature, and I know I'm digressing from identity and authentication here, but I think it is important and kind of relevant to what was talked about earlier. The thing is that the backsync process between Office 365, actually Azure Active Directory, and the Exchange Online Protection Directory, which uses its own directory as well, seems broken because there is a feature in Exchange Online Protection called DBEB, directory-based edge blocking, which means that for every recipient that does not exist in your organization, EOP will actually block the message and tell the sender of the message, I don't know that recipient. We've all been doing this for many, many years, right? So that isn't new. However, you would expect that if you add a secondary email address to a group, that that secondary email address would actually be addressable. That secondary IP, that secondary email address will never get synchronized and as a result is always blocked on the edge in EOP. So going back to synchronizing stuff, as we will discuss in just 1 minute, directory synchronization is a very finicky thing. Now related directly to directory synchronization here, there is that half scenario that I talked about. It's directory synchronization with password synchronization. Why is it half of a scenario? Because you're not changing anything to your identities, right? It's still the same synchronized identity coming from the same source, mostly on-premises Active Directory, but you're adding the password hash so that people in Office 365 or Azure AD can authenticate using the password that they use on-premises. It's same sign-on. It floats in between directory synchronization and a federated identity, which brings me to the third scenario, which is a federated identity. It is a synchronized identity, doesn't necessarily have to be. So I believe the support statement from Microsoft says that in order to do federation, you have to have a synchronized object, which is true. But if you do not have a synchronized object, you can actually make it work with an on-premises federation server if you know what to do. We'll talk about that in just a minute on how to do that. It's quite interesting, actually. Anyway, it's a synchronized object for which Microsoft delegates authentication back to your on-premises organization, typically in the form of a federation server, aka Active Directory Federation Services, ADFS, right? Could be a third-party solution, Okta, Ping, could be even an F5. big IP load balancer with the APM module there, which handles, you know, XAML authentication for you based on Active Directory and so forth and so on, right? It is federated identity because you're doing the authentication for Office 365. As a result, you get a token, and that token gets you into Azure and the related workloads, okay? Just setting the scene a little bit here. Now, as I mentioned, quickly, briefly, directory synchronization, in my opinion, is the root of all evil, of all the problems that we see in Office 365. By extension, that's not entirely true. But why is that? Well, it is a robust process. It works really well. Let's be honest. Azure AD Connect, the newest version of the synchronization tool, is rock solid. Does what it needs to do, does it in a very easy, very comprehensive way. So I don't have anything against it, but as a result of doing directory synchronization, there are some things that you can and cannot do. Let's first start with the synchronization delay. Let me start by telling you that the synchronization delay used to be a much bigger problem. As of version 1.1.19 of Azure AD Connect, it no longer is a 3-hour interval. It's a 30-minute interval, which means that for some actions like provisioning an archive, it takes an hour instead of 6 hours for an archive to be provisioned. Now, you might be wondering, why on earth is that? Why does it take an hour for an archive to get provisioned in Office 365 when I click the button Archive Now? Well, it depends. If you're a cloud-only object in Office 365, just Exchange Mailbox, and you click Enable Archive, within a matter of minutes, the archive is there, just like in an on-premises environment. You just enable the archive for the mailbox, and it shows up eventually after doing 2 or 3 auto-discover requests, right? Nothing new there. In a synchronized, for a synchronized object, the source of authority, meaning the service or server that is responsible for that object, it lives in your on-premises environment, which means it's your Active Directory. So you control what features or the attributes of that object through your on-premises organization. So when you enable an archive, you flip a switch which says archive enabled user. At that point in time, does Office 365 know that you're trying to create an archive for that user? No, why not? You haven't synchronized the change. So let's make it a little bit more specific. On-prem user, on-prem mailbox, cloud archive. An Exchange Online Archive. On-prem mailbox, flip the switch for enable cloud archive, nothing happens. You wait until the synchronization happens, great. Synchronization happens, archive gets created. Awesome, you have an archive. Does your on-premises mailbox know it has an archive? No, why not? So write something back telling them the archive is there and these are the details of your archive. So you have to wait until the second synchronization attempt, and then the on-premises mailbox knows there is an archive. Used to be 6 hours, 3 and 3 is 6, up to 6 hours, right? Because you can be in between two synchronizations when you flip the switch. So it's much better today, but as a result, the synchronization delay could cause some operational, not issues, but things to keep in mind, right? Then there is the sync issues themselves. So once you get into these larger types of deployments with many, many thousands and millions of objects synchronizing to Office 365, you will get into, hey, I've got a duplicate item here or there, or you will run into, this is an unsupported character, or you will run into a customer that has a extension attribute 15 with 6,000 characters in there. Beats me why, but they exist. As a result, the synchronization engine will tell you, hands off, I'm not touching that object because it contains things I cannot synchronize, or it contains things I should not synchronize because Azure AD does not have all the same attributes that it supports at the on-premises environment. And if it does, it doesn't support for sure 6,000 characters in a custom attribute value. I think it supports up to 1,024. Anyway, digressing here. So those are things that you will run into. If you have 2, 3, 5 objects, great, you solve the problem and on you go. If you've got 2, 3, 4, 5,000 objects, it might actually be something that blocks your deployment because you have to solve these issues first. And why is that? Well, typically you start doing directory synchronization because you want to go hybrid, specifically related to Exchange in this case, because you want to move mailboxes. Well, if you do not synchronize all objects to Office 365, then mailboxes in Office 365 don't see the recipients that exist on premises. As a result, if you move one of those mailboxes to Office 365 and they start, you know, interacting with their colleagues, they get all sorts of nice NDRs telling them, hey, I couldn't find this recipient because you're using a X500 legacy address, whatever it is. And I don't know what you're talking about because it never made it into Office 365. So those are all little problems that get amplified once you go over a larger scale. And especially in a multi-forest deployment, you get in those kind of issues where you have previously had two companies, A and B, merge into one big company, but they've already had some Gaussing running before, which means that I have a mailbox here, I potentially have a contact there, and you know that contact has the same email address as that user there, which potentially could create a sort of async issue. You know, luckily, Azure AD Connect handles those types of scenarios pretty well, but you can. Here's a great example. I was trying to think of how to explain this. User object, no exchange attributes whatsoever, right? Template user. Template user has no email at mydomain.com as the Windows email address and has no exchange attributes. I want to create a new user. I'm copying that template user, entering things, whatnot, and then continue doing that. I continue doing that for many, many years, and not all of them get an exchange mailbox, but all of them get synchronized by default to Azure Active Directory. As a result, you might find yourself with lots of users in Office in your on-premises Active Directory that have that Windows email address attribute but no Exchange mailbox, and they will not get synchronized because they don't have a unique Windows email address, which is, doesn't necessarily relate to an actual mailbox in an on-premises Exchange server. Sort of things that you can run into. Anyway, the last one related to synchronizing as well, the sync scope. So by default, if you install AD Connect or DirSync or AD Sync, for as long as you still can, you shouldn't. They will suck up everything in your Active Directory with the exception of a few accounts, few special accounts that are out of scope by default. You can configure filtering on the organizational level, domain level. You could even specify an attribute. Hey, all users that do not have attribute X or Y, I don't want to synchronize them to Office 365. Great. The problem is that by doing this kind of things, you open yourself up to a whole lot of pain in terms of what happens if someone makes a mistake. Now, you can pet yourself as much as you want and tell yourself, I'll never make the mistake of moving user outside of the organizational unit because I never move users in Active Directory. It's not because you don't, that other people don't. Especially in a larger environment where you've got multiple teams working inside Active Directory and you know that team is responsible for those kinds of users and that team is responsible for that. And you told them 6 months ago, this is the EOU of people being synchronized to Office 365. Do not bet your life on the fact that they will never move a user outside the organizational unit. What happens if you only have a scope set to one OU and you move a user outside? Any guess? I know you know, so you can answer. Exactly. So the sync agent or the connector in Azure AD Connect says, ooh, there is a user less, so I'm going to delete the user from the connector space, metaverse. And then it's going to sync up the deletion to Office 365, and the user disappears, and the user cannot log in. Again, if you think it doesn't happen to you, I deleted my own mailbox the other day, just that way, just stupidly enough, but it happens. The good news is solving that problem is fairly easy. Restore original objects, put it back into the sync scope, let it sync back, and from a soft deleted state, your SharePoint library with all its documents, your mailbox with everything else, automatically reappears. Great, right? So that's the good news. Bad news, you do not have an on-premises recycle bin. Oops. What's next if you don't do that? Delete an on-premises object, move it out of scope. Let's say that you accidentally deleted a user account and you do not have the recycle bin enabled. Which brings me to a question, who doesn't have the recycle bin enabled? Be honest. Everyone? Cautious hands in the back? No? Okay. Okay, good. So you're all protected against the scenario that I'm just trying to explain. Restoring the original object is really important because the tie between the object on premises and the object in the cloud is based on a certain attribute, the object GUID by default. And that's the one that is used to identify an object. So if you restore the same object with the same object GUID, it's the same object that gets revived in Office 365 as well. Now, don't panic. If you happen to be in a situation where you deleted the on-premises object, it got synchronized, and you cannot restore the on-premises object, you can do what I like to call a reverse restore. You restore the object in Office 365, you create a blank user on-premises, and you create a hard match between both of them, and then, yay, you lose everything that you had on-premises, but that's not a problem because we're all in the cloud anyway, but you get everything back in the cloud. Good. So how does that work, that tying these things in together? This is a default scenario, right? How objects are linked. An object in a Active Directory has a unique value called the object GUID depicted there. This is a fictive value I picked from one of my test environments. And then when Active Directory syncs that object, and it does that in two steps, it takes that object from Active Directory and puts it into a connector space, which used to be called the metaverse, which is a sort of database that it maintains on premises in order to compare values between objects and only synchronize the changes that were made between two synchronization attempts. So it base64 encodes that string value or that value that it took, writes it into the metaverse as an attribute called the source anchor. As the name implies, that's what anchors the on-premises object to the object in Azure Active Directory. It then, in an export phase, exports that object from the connector space into Azure AD into an object attribute called the immutable ID. Now, there is something really important to learn from that attribute name, immutable ID. Any idea why it's called immutable? Please. Should remain immutable. Yes, thank you. It cannot be changed. Well, it can be changed, but it should not change. Again, why is that? Because, and this kind of brings me back into the multi-forest deployment. It should not change, but it's okay if it changes, and you know that it changes, and you want it to change, right? Why would you? Well, user in organization A synchronized to Office 365, and I move user across forest A to forest B. Leaving aside all the other things that could go wrong, what happens to the object GUID? It changes. What happens to your link to the object? It breaks, because user gone, new user in the place, new object GUID. I'll just create a new user in the cloud. Well, probably wouldn't be able to because all the other attributes are there. It will generate a sync issue and tell you, hey, I've got a conflict, while the other one is deleted because the source object disappeared. That's the reason that why Microsoft tells you if you have multiple deployments or multiple on-premises Active Directory forests, and you have the potential for users moving between forests, that you have to pick another immutable attribute, which could be anything, as long as it is immutable. I've seen organizations take the object GUID and put it into a custom attribute value and make sure that no one ever touches that value ever. Because if you then move the user across and use the custom attribute 1 or 15 or whatever value you want to use as the source anchor, it'll actually move across and stay the same. As a result, the link that we have between the on-premises object and the one in Azure Active Directory remains untouched. That is the secret sauce, and everything else is just automatically works. That's the hard part, which actually isn't that hard when you come to think of it, right? So you can have a multi-forest deployment using the object GUID, and that is just fine, especially if you've got 4 or 5 different Active Directories, and there are just 4 or 5 different entities, and you never plan on moving one user to the other environment. And even if you do, you're okay with first breaking the link, moving the user, recreating the link. As long as you know what to do, you know how to handle it, and that's perfectly fine. Which makes your life a lot easier as well, because you do not have to maintain a custom attribute value. You can just use whatever Active Directory or Azure AD Connect gives to you, right? Now, circling back to connecting objects to one another, there's two ways that you can recreate a link. There is a soft match and there is a hard match. The soft match is something that happens automatically. Remember the customer I talked about with 100,000 accounts in Office 365? Let's just say, theoretically, that customer decides today, you know what? I think it would be an awesome idea if I pull in all those accounts into my on-premises Active Directory because I want to start doing management on those user accounts, or I want to provide them with Active Directory Federation Services authentication, or they need access to another application, or, right? Whatever use case is. Well, there's two ways of going about. Either you do an export of the users and then import them in Active Directory, that's fine. You create brand new user accounts on premises, that's fine as well. But then, do you want to do a hard link, a hard match, where you manually calculate or take the object GUID, calculate the base64 value of that object GUID, and then place it into the matching account in Office 365 in the immutable ID attribute, and then let the director synchronization sync? Or do you want to just make sure that the object on premises matches the object type in Office 365, make sure that the SMTP address, which is unique anyway, matches, and then just click the synchronize button and let the magic happen itself? I prefer option two because it just works really well. And the reason for that being is that the soft matching actually happens in Azure AD. So hard matching is something where when you create the hard match, you manually put the immutable ID in the object in Azure AD. Then what happens is that Azure AD Connect reads from the Active Directory on premises. It reads from Azure Active Directory, creates its connector spaces, metaverse, compares all the values, then all of a sudden sees, oh, you know what, I've got two objects here that seems to be matching because, you know, those values match. So I'll create the link for you and then informs Azure Active Directory, here is the link. In the other scenario, what happens is the connector space or the Azure AD Connect gets the object into the connector space, looks at the object in the cloud, doesn't see a link. So it just tells them, hey, here's what I have, what I need to be exporting. And then Azure AD gets them and sees, oh, hold on, I've got a user here, I've got a user there. The email address match. Well, you know, the email address is unique as well. Let me just glue them together for you. And then it tells Azure AD Connect, you know what? I just calculated the immutable ID, just use that as well as a source anchor in your metaverse and the link is created. Both are equally good. Sometimes it's easier, it's better to create a hard match, especially if you don't have anything to match on, directly, or if you just want to make sure that the match exists for two or three or four or five accounts. You could script all of that as well and just take an object GUI, calculate base64 encoding and do all of that. That's fine. But anyway, so I think I already covered this, didn't I? Yeah. I'm jumping in between slides, so forget about this. But multi-forest and exchange. Let's digress for a second here before diving into other stuff. The trick there is that today, right, and that support statement might change, requires you to have on-premises Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1 at least. If you want to be supported, you'll be on CU 11, 12 anyway. But both organizations have to be. Multi-forest exchange, regardless of the Azure AD Connect thing that you're doing, does not take care of the on-premises bits and pieces. So you set up hybrid, one organization, great. You set up the other exchange organization hybrid, awesome. You've got two separate hybrid connections into one tenant. Those two on-premises environments have no clue they exist. Why? Azure AD Connect does not synchronize between the directories on-premises. Which means that if you want to successfully operate an exchange hybrid deployment or a multi-forest hybrid deployment, in addition to Azure AD Connect, making sure that you've got all those bases covered, you actually have to have something that synchronizes the mailboxes that are still on-premises to the other environment as a contact so that they show up in the GAL on-premises. And you have to make sure that those objects in those environments, Forest B, are not synchronized to Office 365, or you have to make sure that in Azure AD Connect, you check the box which says objects are represented multiple times across multiple forests so that it can combine various objects. So I know it sounds a little bit confusing, but by default, Azure AD Connect assumes an object doesn't just exist in one forest. Great. If you do some sort of GAL sync, the user object might exist in one forest, but there might be a contact object in another forest. If that happens, what Azure Active Directory Connect will do, it has the ability to merge those objects, where if it finds a contact and a user account, it will actually merge the information or, you know, convert the contact into a user account and then synchronize that kind of user account into Office 365. It all depends on what type of what types of objects that you're trying to match, merge, and synchronize into Office 365. So it all goes to explain that the identity stuff underlying, regardless of the workload, whether it's SharePoint or Link or Exchange, is much more important. And carefully planning that is also equally important. And you have to know what you're going to do next. So diving into, let's do the synchronization stuff, and then realizing that you have to do a multi-forest exchange deployment later just isn't fun, because you either have to rethink your identity strategy, have to reconfigure Azure AD Connect, and as a result, for very large environments, have to do a new full, you know, synchronization, which might take quite a while. Okay. So I talked about the limitations of the group write-back, and the reason why I wanted to talk about write-back specifically is that write-back in multi-forest deployments is a little bit finicky. Why is that? So password synchronization, password write-back, you should be fine. Why are you fine? Well, I'm synchronizing an object to Office 365, for which I'm synchronizing a object GUI, and which is a source anchor and immutable, there is a link, right? A link that goes back and forth between both objects. Awesome. Object in the cloud changes password. Password writeback is enabled. The password writeback goes back into the Azure AD Connect server, which then looks up for which object did the password synchronization or password change come in. I'll update the directory where that object actually lives in. Great. Group writeback. How does Azure AD Connect know what Active Directory it needs to write the group into? Care to guess? It doesn't. As a result, it doesn't work. Right? So as long as there is a link between the object for which you're changing something, the writeback would write back in the correct Active Directory for objects, device writeback, user writeback. Technically, it doesn't exist now, right? Group writeback, it wouldn't know. So a multi-forest with these writeback capabilities, no go today, okay? Just keep that in mind. Anyway, let's move over to authentication with ADFS. And some of these schematics here are greatly simplified because of, you know, time constraints and all that. But how does it work from a distance? Let me start by explaining there are many ways in how you can interact with the Federation server today, depending on the client version, and how the client, you know, does authentication. You might either talk directly or indirectly to the ADFS servers. In this case, I'm going to talk about the web authentication flow, also known as the passive authentication flow. User at contoso.com goes to Office 365 and says, "Let me in." Azure AD or Office 365 says, great, but contoso.com is a federated domain. Please go and talk to endpoint X, endpoint X being your ADFS server. So the user gets the redirect, goes to your ADFS server, hits the ADFS server, depending whether it's integrated authentication, forms-based authentication, or any other type of authentication. It authenticates, gets a token, gives that token back to Azure Active Directory, and then Azure Active Directory crafts a logon token and off you go, because there was a prior trust in between both environments. Yay. Now, before we dive into some of the other stuff, I want to talk about the ADFS server farm. If you deploy an ADFS server farm, how many servers do you deploy? One, two, three, four, five, six, two. Minimum two. Okay. I can relate to that. With or without web. Web being the web application proxy. ADFS proxy version. Two webs. So everyone goes with four servers from the get-go, right? Really? Are you kidding me? You're all lying. Why do I find all these customers with one or two servers and no WAPs? Right? You should theoretically do that. And why is that? Well, first of all, from a high availability point of view, yes. We'll talk about the WAP and why you want to deploy the WAP in just a minute. But if you deploy an ADFS server, Windows Internal Database or SQL, go. SQL, okay. Why? You can do load balancing with SQL. Now, that's an interesting statement. Let's table that for a second. Anyone else? There. How large is your environment? You should be fine. You're probably referring to the local DB instance for Azure AD Connect, which is limited to about 50,000 objects, 50 to 100,000 objects. And there you'll have to use a SQL database for the synchronization engine. I fully agree. Here we're talking about ADFS. Yeah, just no worries, no, don't worry, that's fine, that's fine. So the question is, we have ADFS requirements. Do we use a Windows internal database or do we use SQL? I have one vote for SQL because of load balancing. Anyone else? Come on. Windows internal database. Great. Why? Because it's easier. Yes. Thank you. So I have a confession to make. I am by default in lazy mode. Any work I can avoid doing, I will. Ask my wife. So I am a big fan of the Windows internal database for a variety of reasons. Let's first take a look at how both database thingies work, if you will. If you use the Windows internal database, it's the default way of installing a Federation server. Yes, there is a theoretical primary Federation server, which is responsible for writing any configuration change into the ADFS configuration database. And every 5 minutes, all other Federation servers in the Federation server farm will pull that information from the primary Federation server and synchronize and make sure they are all in sync. What happens if the first server fails? Anyone care to guess? There you go. It still works, but you cannot make any configuration changes. Now, anyone wants to tell me, how often do you make configuration changes to your ADFS server? Not that much. So, how big of a problem is it that your primary Federation server goes down? Not a big problem. I don't think so either. Okay, great. Especially knowing that you can promote a secondary server to a primary server and be done with it, right? You promote a secondary server to a primary server, go to each of the other secondary servers and tell them there's a new primary and life is good. Okay, so that's one myth busted. For high availability purposes, you don't necessarily need SQL. Okay, load balancing. Each server has its own database, or all servers go to a load balanced pair of databases. Now, we all know Exchange, and we like the fact that every server has its own set of databases, right? It creates a lot of high availability and load balancing and whatnot. So in this case, I would argue that having multiple servers, each with their own database that's kept in sync with a process that actually synchronizes and manages itself, for which you don't have to do anything, works great. Awesome. One thing I used to hear a lot is scalability, but it's not an issue anymore. Who is aware that the limitation of five servers has been lifted and you can go to 30 servers now in a Federation server farm with Windows internal database? 30 servers. You can have a shitload of users on a 30 server ADFS farm authenticating and still have enough of, performance left, right? So scalability is not really a problem. It might be if you are using your ADFS server farm for a variety of applications, because there is one limitation that still exists. Well, it's a limitation, 100 relying party trusts that you can configure because of the limitation in the database size and all that and so forth and so on. 100 relying party trusts. Office 365 is one relying party trust. If you are using ADFS for the sole purpose of Office 365, then we're at the point that we had scalability. Nope, we want to use the internal database. Performance, nope, we still want to use it. We still want to use the internal database. High availability. Oh, leaves us with security, right? Okay, how about security? I read a lot of things about SAML artifact resolution, token replay detection. That must be great. I want it. Anything that prevents me to replay a token, I want it. And I agree, to a certain extent. Why do people think that token replay detection is so important? Well, they know Kerberos and how Kerberos prevents you to do a token replay just for the sole purpose of avoiding that someone actually, you know, sniffs your traffic and then tries authenticating you or reusing a token that you just got, right? So oversimplifying things, but that's the idea. Must be the same thing. It actually is. What token replay detection does is a very common scenario. I'm at the airport and I'm using a public computer because I'm a person who has never had a laptop of my own. My company doesn't want to pay for one, so I actually use these computers, which I never see anymore, almost. They still exist. I log in on that computer. And then I log into Office 365 and I have my email open. And then I just close the email, leave the browser open because that's just what I do, and walk away. Someone else comes in and says, oh, this is interesting. Back on the browser, log in again, and I'm in. That is the theory behind a token replay, where a browser, just a minute, I'll let you talk about it, where a browser could reuse a token already issued to re-authenticate into an application. And it happens. There used to be a time where you could actually do that. Now, token replay detection protects the application, not the Federation service. It's not the Federation service that it doesn't prevent the Federation service of handing out a new token. It prevents that a new token can be used for that specific application. Office 365 has been written to not accept the same token twice. As a result, going back and going forth again in the same browser after you've done a log off, right? Important, doesn't work because Office 365 will be like new. So, knowing that SAML artifact resolution is not used by Office 365 and that Office 365 is built to not accept replay tokens, what is the value of the token replay detection which you only get with the SQL database? You may in just a minute. I don't think there's all that much. Sure, if you use your ADFS Federation services for a lot of other features and other applications which you do not control and are maybe perhaps poorly written, yes, by all means, sure. But if you don't, then think twice. Why on earth would I deploy an always-on SQL availability group, which, you know, from a configuration perspective in Federation services is a real pain because you have to configure a Federation server first to then point it to a SQL database, which you then add to an always-on availability group, which then creates a lot of complexity because now you have to manage the Federation services form and the always-on availability group. And, you know, there's valid reasons. I'm just saying that you should think about it twice. But you had a question about SQL. Sure. Yes.
I want to add that specific second or third or fourth investor to the ADFS farm, and it's using a Windows internal database,
yeah,
which is load balanced between several ADFS servers. I don't know which is the primary server.
It doesn't need to.
So you have to use it.
Yeah. So if you create a relying party trust and, for instance, I'm talking to ADFS server 3, the way that it writes the configuration is it accepts the configuration change, hands it off to the primary, which writes it into the configuration database and pushes it back to your configuration database. So it's like, I can accept it for you. I can't write, but I know someone who can. So let me hand it off to him. he'll write into the database and then give it back to me. It's like the government all over, right? Yeah, I'll accept the paper, but I'm not doing anything, just giving it to someone else. That's what happens. So doesn't matter at all. Wow. Government ADFS. Anyway, let's move on. Multi-forest authentication or multi-forest deployments and authentication. Great. Good news is, yes, you can use a single ADFS server farm to authenticate multiple Active Directories for as long as those Active Directory forests have a forest trust. Why is that? Anyone has a guess? This has more to do with Active Directory than it actually has to do with Azure or anything else. But why is it that it works? Nope. Not really on behalf, kind of looks like it. It's based on the UPN, right? Because as soon as you create a forest trust, one of the things that these Active Directory forests exchange with one another is, I'm responsible for these UPNs, and the other one says, and I'm responsible for these UPNs, so that, depending on the forest trust that you've created, that one forest can actually forward authentication requests to your forest so that your domain controllers can handle that authentication and then reply back and say, yep, it's okay. It's like Kerberos, you know, cross-forest works pretty much the same way. It's called UPN suffix routing. Now, that works great as long as both forests use different UPN suffixes. Like in this scenario, Fabricum and Contoso. Great. As soon as this one here starts to use contoso.com, you're out. No more authentication for Active Directory 2. Why is that? Well, the request is received by an ADFS server farm in Active Directory 1. It knows that this Active Directory is responsible for contoso.com, so it will not even attempt to go to ADFS or AD2 or forward the authentication request to the second Active Directory because there can only be a single Active Directory responsible for one UPN at a time. As soon as you add the other UPN or a same UPN as in the first forest into the other forest, the UPN suffix writing for that UPN is or UPN suffix is disabled and it breaks authentication. So when your marketing department sneaks by and says, we want to use the same UPN everywhere, you tell them no. In this scenario, no. Because one domain in one tenant cannot point to two Federation server farms. One domain, one farm, multiple forests. Yay. One domain, one farm, multiple forests. One domain, two farms. That's the only thing. That's the only reason. Now, you could do all sorts of trickery. Alternate login ID, making sure that you know the claims that you're getting, check group. Check group membership and do all sorts of additional authentication. But the problem that I have with these custom authentication flows is that they complicate things a lot. And as a result, you get all sorts of funky stuff, right? So let's throw in modern authentication into the mix. I just find it really interesting that Microsoft calls modern authentication modern because it's what it should have been for the past many years. Anyway, modern authentication changes how clients authenticate because they use a new authentication scheme based on the Active Directory authentication library, which is not so new, but it's new enough to call it modern, new, and whatever it is, right? Previously, if you had an Outlook client, excuse my French, I know this is being recorded, but Outlook is a stupid client at times when it comes to authentication because it could only do basic authentication before. Modern authentication actually integrates the new web authentication flow into the application so that it supports multi-factor authentication and so forth natively into the client. Beautiful. By default in Outlook 2016, you can enable it in Outlook 2013. You should. Going forward, you can bet that anything that Microsoft does is in light of this, right? So you should definitely look forward to using modern authentication as much as you can. There are some caveats because modern authentication doesn't work with all clients across the board yet. It'll get there, but definitely keep that in mind, right? It just changes how legacy applications, even on the mobile devices like The new Outlook client on the iOS uses modern authentication, which fully in the application supports multi-factor authentication, unlike ActiveSync on the Windows Phone device, which doesn't use modern authentication, creating all sorts of other problems. Anyway, custom claim rules. As I said, I am not necessarily a fan of modifying the authentication behavior, but sometimes you have to in order to support your authentication needs. Which means that if you want to do selective authentication or granular authentication, at some point, let's just say that you've got a group of users that are synchronized to Office 365 and you want to give some of them access to Office 365 and others you don't want them to authenticate, then either you do not synchronize them, you disable them in Office 365 so they cannot log on in Office 365, or you avoid them being able to authenticate in ADFS. Now, just as easily, you could use the same set of rules to enforce multi-factor authentication for a set of users and not for a different set of users. You might ask me, well, why would you do this the complicated way if we can just enable one user for MFA and the other not enable them and just achieve the same? Ha! Huh. That's true. But sometimes you want to use an on-premises Active Directory Federation Server farm with multi-factor authentication for multiple applications and not only Office 365. And then you have to revert to doing this. Now, without going into too much detail, because there we could talk about the virtues of custom claim rules and claim rule language, which in my opinion is bloody a mess. But there are AARs and EARs, or the additional authorization rules. And it's very easy. Use an additional authorization or authentication rule to add another authentication option. Claim comes in, authentication request comes in, make sure that it does multi-factor authentication. That is an additional authentication rule. The issuance authorization rule can be used to achieve the same. If a request comes in that is not multi-factor authenticated, then do not issue a token. You could do the same, but the issuance authorization rules are a better way to actually, deny access and make sure that applications are not allowed to or get a token, like deny a token or apply a token or check something before you issue a token, right? Additional authentication, deny or grant a token. You could do the same with both, and actually using the issuance authorization rules is a little bit easier because you've got a GUI that helps you doing it. The additional authentication rules are mainly PowerShell based and can be somewhat tricky to work with, but essentially, you know, the idea behind both of them is the same. Now, why am I mentioning this here? Is because if you want to do today still a conditional access to Office 365 based on the device, based on the location, Microsoft actually tells you to create these issuance authorization rules that looks for the IP address and that looks for specific claims that come in. Little primer on Active Directory Federation Services. How does it work? Claims come in. Claims means I claim to be Michael and I claim this to be my name and I claim this to be my device. That is what the Active Directory Federation Server gets. Uses that information along with the username and password that you provided in order to verify all that information against a set of rules and whatnot to actually grant your token or not. Very high level basic primer on how these the claims pipeline works, right? Now, the problem is that not every application submits the same set of claims. And sometimes you need to rely on other solutions like the web application proxy in order to see specific claims. So the web application proxy, yes, it secures your environment. That is true. But you could just as easily use a very smart and very expensive firewall and achieve exactly the same. So why would you have that expensive F5 load balancer that does application publishing and still use a web application proxy? And I realize that F5 is a really bad example because they have a module that can do the same. But just for the sake of it, you've got, you know, the reverse proxy. Let's call it a reverse proxy without a name. Why would you deploy a web application proxy after that reverse proxy in the first place? Because the web application proxy is an ADFS proxy server and it injects a claim into an incoming claim, which allows you to differentiate traffic from internal traffic and external traffic. And that is something you can use to build these custom claim rules so that you can tell or create a rule that says if it's internal, just let it go through. If it's an external, do multi-factor authentication. Could make sense. These are the types of things that you can do. Now beware, because today you could have applications that use modern authentication, that could use ActiveSync, that could use an Outlook client with basic authentication, or an Outlook client with modern authentication. All these different authentication schemes, for some reason, they don't have the same claims. They don't adhere to the same rule sets, and so forth and so on. So it might just as well be that you create a rule which works great for Outlook and then breaks for an ActiveSync client. It might mean that you have to create multiple rules to achieve the same using these custom claim rules. So just pointing that out. Anyway, I've got 4 minutes left, and I'm probably going to go over time a little bit when talking about multi-factor authentication, because I think it's really important that we just briefly talk about that. Multi-factor authentication isn't new. In fact, we've been using it for many, many years. For instance, if you want to build access control, it's one of the first places where they started using multi-factor authentication, because you needed a key and a fingerprint to get into a secure room. Something I have and something I am. It's more than one factor. We're using it many, many years without even thinking about it, right? Well, we're just reapplying that into the world of IT, and we've been doing it for many years. I remember starting off work 12, 15 years ago, and I got these RSA token back in the day that allowed me to log in externally into the application for that organization. So we all know what it is. Why? I love this cartoon. I'm pretty sure that most of you have seen this, but it is oh so true. Just when looking at passwords from a compute perspective, what you can do and cannot do, a complex password does not necessarily mean that it is secure, because it can easily be cracked if it's a short one, right? A complex password, which is long, well, what happens? People start writing it down, right? And the other day I was thinking about it, I bought a solution to manage all my passwords. Why? I just cannot remember, for the love of God, all the passwords I have with all the identities and all the platforms and everything else. But that application protects all my passwords with one single kick-ass long password that I need to remember. That's some really hard for me, because it's like way too long. But I can cope. It's better than not doing anything, but still, it's really hard. We're not made to do that. On top of that, a lot of people said, you know what, let's just go to these extreme berserk long passwords of 55 characters and create a phrase out of it, like I'm walking my dog in the pool outside, whatever passphrases. As it turns out, there is an interesting report that was published. Some researchers in the university in the United States found out that people revert to using the same words based on their own language and where they grew up and all that. So they could reliably predict the sorts of words that you were going to use in those passphrases, and as a result, undermine the very thing that they were trying to solve, the ability to crack them. As it turns out, it's harder, but still easy enough to guess. So we have to get away from passwords. That's why we get to multi-factor authentication, because the password alone is not enough anymore. Office 365, Microsoft Cloud comes with three types of multi-factor authentication for free, for nothing, for you to use today. Everyone's using it, of course. We all nod. Office 365 MFA, right? Only works for Office 365 workloads. You've got Azure MFA, which works for all the cloud workloads, all third-party applications, and Office 365, but comes at a premium, Azure AD Premium or EMS license required. For the first one, no additional license. For the second one, yes. Or there is the on-premises version of the Azure MFA called the Azure Authentication Server, which brings all the goodness of Azure MFA to the on-premises world and then some. Right? Three flavors of what you can do. This is not a feature overview. I'm not going to go into detail what it can do. Right? Just pointing out what there is. Now, thing is, multi-factor authentication in the real world works really well. I use it. I encourage everyone to use it as well. But there are some caveats. Remote PowerShell in Exchange Online does not use MFA, doesn't support MFA. So if your account, admin account, MFA protected, which kind of is the purpose of having an admin account and MFA enable it, because it's like a high security account, I want to make sure it's secure, no longer Exchange Online PowerShell. What is Microsoft's solution? app passwords. App passwords are 16 characters long passwords which you cannot remember. I'm really sorry, but that's like, you know, yes, we have MFA, and now we're going to give you an app password. And sure, the app password itself is generated after you authenticate it with MFA once. But if I then take that password and store it in a text file and reuse it everywhere else, it'll just accept it. It beats the purpose. Honestly, I cannot wrap my head around the fact that Microsoft has app password. Furthermore, going back to those passphrases, and I'm going over time, just 2 minutes, bear with me. Those app passwords, the problem that we have there is 16 characters. Microsoft Azure Active Directory does not support passwords beyond 16 characters. Beats me. Why? Beats me, really. Because you cannot do, even if you wanted to, you cannot create a 22 character password. You can't. 16 is the limit. Anyway, digressing here. The MFA authentication flow, I'm not going to go into detail. Let's just say that in between authentication with the Federation server handing you a token, which it does, and you actually getting a token from Azure, there is an additional step, which is, oh, you need to do multi-factor authentication. Let me pass you through to the multi-factor authentication service, which then does something, which could be send you a text message, give you a phone call, send you a notification on your mobile device, make you enter a PIN code, whatever it is. Once that second authentication or verification process is successful, it'll actually give you a token which you can use in Azure Active Directory to get a logon token and be on your way. Now, all this, how does that fit into Passport, Microsoft Passport? First of all, does everyone know what Microsoft Passport is? You're done with it. It's like, Michael, you've been talking for an hour. Please let us go. Okay, so Passport is a new feature which takes away the need for a password, in theory, right? It's a sort of credential vault which lives within your hardware. Could be software as well, but let's not go there today. Encrypts it cryptographically, which is inherently more secure than a password. And then by using some sort of multi-factor authentication, which could be Windows Hello. Like, this is my device, and this is my face. I hope no one can steal my face, but show it to the camera. The camera authenticates my face, says, okay, this is Michael. I verified Michael on a number of points, and the fact that his nose points that way and his eyes that way and whatnot, and then uses that information to log me onto the computer because I am authenticated to the computer, because that device is trusted by the service. And today you can only do that with Azure Active Directory. So you join your computer to Azure Active Directory, you unlock your computer locally. Because you can unlock your computer locally, Microsoft knows that you can be trusted because you were able to unlock that specific device with your specific characteristics. As a result, you have a device and you have that face fingerprint PIN code, which means that there is multi-factor authentication. So it unlocks the vault. You then go to Office 365 and want to log in into the portal. The portal will actually pick up on the fact that he's trying to use a device that I know, and he has unlocked the vault. I'm going to let you in because you already authenticated with that computer, which I trust. So I don't need your password. Keep it. I don't want to see it. I know that you can be trusted because you have authenticated, which in the end, and this is a long story, very short, is much more secure. The password never goes over the wire and you never use the password. You just use something you are, fingerprints, RF scan, facial recognition, and on that device. A token like a Windows Hello only works for that specific device. So if I would now take a different computer and have it Azure AD joined, then facial recognition will not work because that facial recognition creates the keys needed to unlock the vault, the passport vault on that computer. The fingerprint I register on that device is cryptographically stored in the vault in the TPM module of that device. So it must be this device that unlocks me that is trusted by Azure before I can actually do that seamless logon to Office 365. And that's really interesting because, as I mentioned, today you can only do that with Azure AD. In the future, you will be able to do that with on-premises Windows Server 2016, where you can, you know, have directory joined computers, unlock yourself in the domain and authenticate to the domain and then do a single sign-on with all the need of ADFS and all that to Office 365 because there is a trust between both organizations through that password thingy, right? Or you can have devices joined in Azure AD, written back into the on-premises organization so that other applications that you write that are passport capable because it's an API can leverage the same information for a device that is joined in Azure AD. So I truly believe that this is a really, really beautiful solution for the years coming, and that we can see a lot of practical applications of it. And if you have Windows 10 today, whether or not you have a RealSense camera, which means a Surface 4, you can just do it like I do. I have this device with a device-specific PIN, and I use Windows Hello all the time. So I have single sign-on to all my Office 365 applications, and I don't even use an ADFS server. Works great. The only premises is I have to join it to an Azure Active Directory because Windows Server 2016 isn't there yet. This being said, way over time, if you have any questions, you can find me in the hallway. Thank you.